Servus and greetings from Vienna. My name is Anita Posch. Thank you for listening to Bitcoin und Co., my podcast that's introducing the philosophy, ideas and people behind Bitcoin. Hello people, it's Anita and the Bitcoin and Co. podcast again. Thanks for tuning in. Last week's episode was the first that has also been broadcasted on the Let's Talk Bitcoin network, where you can also find shows like Let's Talk Bitcoin with Andreas Antonopoulos, Adam Levine and Stephanie Murphy, What Bitcoin Did with Peter McCormick, the Bitcoin Magazine podcast, POV Crypto, The Tatiana Show and much, much more. Make sure to check them out on Twitter at the LTB Network and make sure to subscribe to their feed and please also to my feed. You can find it on all the major podcast platforms. This is episode 37 and my guest today is Austin Alexander. Austin is working for the Office of the CEO at Kraken. He joined Kraken at the end of 2013. Back then, he was one of the first 30 or 40 employees. Today, Kraken is one of the biggest crypto exchanges in the world. I met Austin at several Bitcoin conferences this year, and at the Baltic Honey Badger in Riga in October, we finally sat down to chat about his career and the developments in the Bitcoin space since 2011. In 2013, he was co-founding the Bitcoin Center New York with Nick Spanos. He talks about how enthusiastically they have built the center and about the problems they ran into in the dawn of the BitLicense. We also discuss his learnings in 2019 while visiting Uganda, Somalia, South Africa and Zimbabwe, and much more. As always, you can find all recommendations and links mentioned in this episode in the show notes on the episode page at bitcoinandco.com. That's bitcoinundco.com. There you can also find a books page with all reading recommendations from my guests. Before we start, a message from my sponsors. If you want to be independent and secure your personal financial freedom with Bitcoin, you have to hold your own keys and must not use a custodial wallet. There are several ways to achieve that. One is to use a well-built hardware wallet like the Bitbox O2 by Shift Crypto Security from Switzerland. They have two versions, a Bitcoin-only to minimize the attack surface even further, and a multi-edition for a variety of coins. With their upcoming app for Android, you can connect the hardware wallet directly with your phone and send and receive Bitcoin on the go. Check it out at shiftcrypto.ch. That's shiftcrypto.ch. You'll get free shipping with the code ANITA. So hello and welcome to a new episode of the Bitcoin and Co. podcast. My guest today is Austin Alexander. Hi, Austin.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having me here.
Hello. Thanks for taking the time to do this interview. You're, as far as I know, you're working at or for Kraken. How do you say it, actually?
I think either way is fine. I think most Americans, although there might be some regional exceptions, I think most Americans say Kraken, and most of the rest of the world says Kraken. As far as I understand, it means octopus in German.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the funny part when I first met you. You were eating a rather big octopus.
Yeah, actually the whole thing. All eight arms and the rest.
Everything,
but not the beak.
It was quite impressive for me. Please tell us, what's your story? I mean, what's your education and how did you end up at Kraken?
Sure, yeah. So as far as my education goes, I mostly studied about demographics and demographic analysis. I think the only real job for that is in the census, perhaps, but I didn't stick around long enough to figure it out. And after I graduated school, I started selling some fruits, distributing fruits, and Then I started during the 2008 crisis. I would I basically was showing up to warehouses that were full of stock that was on the edge of being foreclosed on or whatever, offering them pennies on the dollar and reselling all sorts of random stuff. And yeah, it was a interesting experience because for about a year, more than a year, every single day I was meeting people who were on the edge of complete and total financial annihilation. And I had been reading about monetary policy since I was in high school. I ran across some book in, when I was about 16 or something, and it was about like the central bank, the Federal Reserve, and the break from gold in 1971. I can't really remember the name of the book, but then from that I started. First of all, I thought it was fake, really, because when this book describes how the central bank works, how the Federal Reserve works, and that it's a, you know, a private, you know, technically a private institution that prints money to hand out to their friends, you know, or somebody in the privileged class, I didn't really believe that that's how it worked. You know, I don't know why, but, you know, I think some people who don't, and this is probably most people, but who don't get into monetary policy, at least in the U.S. and maybe the world over, they still believe that there's some tie between the fiat currencies, government currencies, and gold. I guess there is a small tie in that, especially as of the last decade, central banks are acquiring more gold. They seem to be acquiring a lot more gold, but you know, there is no technical link.
Yeah, but I think the argument is that, like, the nation state as a whole, the economy, stands behind it.
Perhaps, but only because the participants in that economy are forced at, by gunpoint, by from the government, who claims a monopoly on violence. They're forced to utilize that that to pay their fees, their tribute to the benevolent leaders that is known as taxation. And should they not do any of these things, they would be imprisoned, and ultimately, should they claim their sovereignty to not be thrown in a cage by random strangers for not paying the tribute, they will be murdered. So when what it really is backed by is an explicit, not implicit, it's what government currencies are really backed by is an explicit threat to murder you should you not utilize them, essentially.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, maybe you can explain that to me. I mean, that's quite a very libertarian standpoint. And I mean, I think you're coming from that side when I see your work history and stuff that you did. But does in the end, what's your view on that? I mean, how should people live without a state?
Well, I don't know. I just think that I mean, look, I have ideas, and mostly it's just me would regurgitating, you know, famous economists or authors that I've read, or political thinkers, philosophers. But I you know, I have some maybe organic ideas. But to not go too into the weeds, I think that we've seen the march throughout history, at least in recent history, the recent centuries, has been towards more and more individual autonomy. So I think all the functions of the state ultimately can be done voluntarily without violence. I don't necessarily think that the functions of the state, well, I mean, definitely some of the functions of the state as they claim it today are necessary. You know, the state builds the roads. Others could build. The reality is the state doesn't build the roads. The state then contracts out to private enterprise. Most places, a private enterprise would then build the roads. So it's not even really true. But I have a ability to rant and not be very...
It's okay.
But I think that if you zoom out in history and look at where we are, we're on a course towards more voluntary and more sovereignty for the individual, hopefully. And I think we can't. The state is violence. The state, the entire, it's backed by violence. And I think that we can eliminate violence from human interactions and relations. And there's a lot of facets to how that will come around. And maybe it takes a long, long time and another millennia or so. But I think it's possible.
I think it's backed by hierarchy in the first place, isn't it? I mean, and like Bitcoin is something like a decentralized autonomous organization. So maybe that's the way. Is this where you think that's going?
I mean, yeah, I think Bitcoin is a complete and total game changer when it comes to the relationship between, the residents of a tax farm and the state. It's an opt out from what is probably the most abused and abusable tool that the state has, and it's and the thing about central banking and modern era Keynesian monetary policy is that it's a very insidious control. When somebody marches into your city with a tank and points a rifle at you, it's obvious. It's very obvious. But the way that that states utilize monetary policy towards their ends at the expense of whoever lower classes in those states, the way that they do that is not widely understood, and I believe most don't want it to be widely understood. When you look at and this has been, a lot of this has been published televised recently of all the various, I mean literally all the central banks the world over announcing their next round of easing in the last 2 months, and it's all coded in language that's legal and academic language, economic language of the legacy economic academy, which is not a science, I should say. We're gonna get touch into that. I mean, the way that economics is, it's not science. They coded in this language that is forcibly is purposefully opaque. They don't come out and say we're gonna print tons of new money and we're gonna give it to the banker friends to figure out what to do with, because that doesn't sound so great, I don't think, from a political perspective, rhetorical perspective. They say, oh, we're gonna have quantitative easing and we're going to increase the balance sheet to so that banks have more liquidity for stimulating the economy or whatever,
Yeah, I mean, from the monetary policy side, it's true. I mean, you never learn what it's actually about. So nobody knows where money comes from. You just take it as like God given, money is the euro or the Austrian shilling. When I grew up, it's there, but you never question where it comes from. And to be honest, when I realized what Bitcoin can be, I started to research about the fact, where does money come from? What is the central bank? And it was really eye-opening. And I'm not a proponent of privatizing everything, because, for instance, in England, Thatcherism, they privatized the railroads, for instance, and then nothing worked. So I think a basis infrastructure should be provided by the state. But nonetheless, I say there are many inefficiencies there, of course. I really believe that the monetary policy of the central banks is not sufficient, because what we've seen in the last 20 years is the rich are getting richer and the poor, or the middle class is getting poorer. And as far as I have learned in one of the books of Austrian national economics, is that, and I have a feeling that it's true, is that the money that is created by the banks at first gets into the hands of the people working at the banks and in their surroundings. And that's also explanation for me why the rich are getting richer.
And I think in Europe, the central bank goes straight to buying assets.
Yes.
And obviously rich people own assets. The poor people don't own assets.
That's so exactly the point.
When you go and when you're buying equities and even sovereign. So the when you're buying equities, it's like completely perverse. But even something that maybe more people would agree with would be buying sovereign debt. Like basically that's monetizing sovereign debt. You're penalizing all savers, every saver, to give more, even more money to a system that has shown that it can't use, they can't properly utilize the money, right? When you extend credit, the credit is supposed to be used for productive ends, and if it can't be paid back, it's a sign that something has gone wrong, that there has that production has not been created, that value has not been created.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what do you think about like things like security token offerings? I mean, there's a lot of talking about it, like, okay, then we finally can utilize properties and everybody can have a small share and it's very liquid and that's good for the market. But will it not then in the end raise the rent for the small people again?
I don't know what like tokenizing real estate, what effect it would ultimately have on rents. I think that rents, the increase in rents is much more a byproduct of people running to escape quantitative easing and money printing, because there's a level of utility you get out of the house. I don't know what it is. Let's just say we have some house and we can get $10,000, subjective value of course, but some $10,000 of utility out of it. But if I'm making whatever, let's say I'm making $50,000 a year and I have $40,000, $30,000, $20,000 I want to save, I can't just, it requires a lot of effort to get away from having your money drained by the central banks. And the part that really is kind of astonishing to me, as you see masses of the mainstream and just tons of people not questioning this, is that the central banks say this. They say that the reason why they're doing this is to stimulate consumption. They say that it is to spur consumption. That's not very environmentally friendly. So anyway, what I was saying is that one of the reason why rents go up is because people run to real estate and put all sorts of extra value above and beyond the utility that they're getting from living out it or the level of housing they would otherwise desire, you know. So then maybe they'll ask for to build an even bigger house. They want to have even more land. They want even, you know, nicer appliances. Tear that building down, make me a 1-5 times bigger. And so those that are not the property class find it far more difficult to get into housing, and that rents go up with that process.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the point where you said you were selling stuff in 2008. What did you do afterwards?
Yeah, so I went to work at what's called the Mercatus Center. It's like an economic policy think tank in DC. And there at the Mercatus Center, I learned about Bitcoin a few months after I joined. And that was in April 2011. I had a really... I had a really bad computer that couldn't really run what I think at the time was the only Bitcoin software available. They called it Bitcoin D back then, but I think it's pretty much the same project that is Bitcoin Core today. So I had that running on one of my like office computers, and I had a little bit of Bitcoin on there, and then I kind of just, you know, when actually what happened was the price went down from somewhere around like $25 or $30 to like $2 or $3 in one weekend. And I hadn't checked the price. And so I came back to work, and maybe on that the next Monday or Tuesday, I saw that the price had collapsed, and I thought that I had been scammed, essentially. I couldn't explain it, but I was like, oh, this is horrible, because I didn't quite understand how the time chain worked.
Yeah, but it's funny that you say that, because just before we had a panel, they were talking about education in and about Bitcoin, and they said everybody gets wrecked on a point in this journey. And I've heard so many stories from people who lost their keys or their computer or anything. So it's quite interesting. And I think you learn a lot about it then.
But it's good for those people that are still holding Bitcoin.
Yeah,
I agree. That was the only way I was learning about it then, because I was looking for resources and there weren't many available, to be perfectly honest. You know, I don't remember it in much detail, but I think I would Google around and left more confused than when I started. And it actually wasn't until, so then after that happened, I left that that job, and it wasn't until maybe a year and a half later. I think it was actually New Year's Eve on January 2013, 2012 into 2013, so New Year's of 2013, that then I kind of thought about Bitcoin again, because I had just received a text from a friend of mine who I speak to once every 3 years, and he said, "Wow, Bitcoin's moving." And I had never remembered speaking to this guy about Bitcoin. I hardly talked to him. I never remembered speaking to him about Bitcoin, and I was like, "Whoa, Bitcoin! What is he writing to me about Bitcoin?" I hadn't thought about it in a long time, and I looked, and it was—I don't know what it was—$50 or $60, and then from there, I've been basically obsessed ever since.
Okay, your professional life started then also with Bitcoin, or
yeah. So, and we were, I was working with Nick Spanos on. Who later got really into Bitcoin as well. I was working with Nick Spanos on a campaign consulting firm. So we were doing some micro targeting for political campaigns. I was writing like scripts for phone bankers and stuff like that, and we were doing some analysis and I guess that's how the campaigns work. And we're mostly for phone banks and such. And then, so I just started getting into the community. And then at some point during 2013, I had a much less ambitious idea, but, the fantastic Nick Spanos, who he knows very well, he said, "No, we got to do it bigger. We have to open a physical exchange." So we were discussing making an exchange, because the exchanges then were horrible. I was completely naive. I had no idea how, existing legacy exchanges worked. I had no idea. I didn't have much. I didn't really understand KYC. I had, I hadn't done much financial anything. Then haven't done much banking. I usually just kept cash on me, stuff like that. So we thought to make an exchange, and then he said, "No, we need to have a physical." Towards the middle of the year, he's saying we need to have a physical exchange right next to. So his background was in Manhattan real estate. So then his mind went to, "No, we need, you know, the biggest building with the biggest sign, and we need to make it right next to the New York Stock Exchange, so that when all the tourists come and see the New York Stock Exchange, they can see the future." And actually, the 1 year later, which was January New Year's Eve 2013, it opened. And we had the Bitcoin Center of New York opened. We were hosting peer-to-peer trading nights. And sometimes they traded a lot of coins then. It was like, back then it was only like really Mt. Gox for the first few months. And I remember one day we traded, after Mt. Gox, it would have been the second largest exchange in the world for that day. And we were doing some other things. We were doing educational seminars daily, multiple times daily.
Mm-hmm. And were there many people coming?
Yeah, at that point, because luckily the price was exploding. So it wasn't nothing like 2017, but it was there was a lot of people coming, and including all the people working around in the Wall Street, Lower Manhattan area. You know, a lot of people that I still know to this day that came in there. And just say, "Well, what is Bitcoin? Tell me about it. I see, you know, I can make money off of it, or I've heard about it. You know, teach me more." And on it, but honestly, I was the one who learned the most from doing all that, because, talking about it all day, every day for months and months and months. I was very lucky, to be honest. Mm.
Teaching learns you something, yeah.
Oh yeah, most.
And how did you make money back then?
We didn't make much. I don't think we made any money. I think we lost buckets and buckets of money, because basically what happened is, I don't have to get into all the details, but very, very shortly, a very short time after we launched the Bitcoin Center, the New York Department of Financial Services had announced that they were going to create this Bit license. Actually, as we were setting up the center, they did their first they subpoenaed a bunch of Bitcoin companies while we were kind of planning and setting it up. So, you know, that was a little, we got a little nervous at that point, but we went ahead with it. You know, the rent at the venue was something astronomical, $30,000 a month or maybe more. I don't know. I forget, but a lot. So, yeah, so the New York Department of Financial, we had a lot of plans to link up a, actually it was built out. We had an exchange platform that worked and it was built out. But we just were never launched it because, the New York Bit license, which I think because we were familiar with licensing, but it was, it wasn't like a financial licensing, you know, none of us had, you know, our Series 7 or anything. We had, Nick was a real estate broker, so he had a bunch of real estate licenses throughout the country, and I had that license, and I guess nothing else really, but I didn't foresee it being like a 7-year application process. I thought we were going to be good, you know, before the end of the year, and then we would launch the website. Yeah, so things got very stressful. You know, we had spent a fortune on legal bills. Bitcoin went from $1,000 to, you know, whatever, $200 or something like that over 18, you know, but during that year, I mean, it was down the whole time during the whole year. So, yeah, so the financially, it wasn't looking good at that point, but
the center is still there.
The center is still there. There's a different location.
So you left then and
I got tired of New York. I realized that the license was specifically made to shut us down, which I hadn't realized in the beginning of the year. But towards May, I was, after all this communication and all these lawyers and paying all these lawyers so that we could teach them what Bitcoin was. We would go into these legal meetings and they'd have this whole opinion written out. And we say, what is this? This makes no sense. We told you what our business is. So we just paid all these lawyers to teach them about Bitcoin, to be perfectly honest. So by May or June, I kind of realized that, which, you know, should seem obvious to me, but I wasn't. But I realized that the license was put in place to shut us down. You know, maybe others as well in our ilk, but we were exactly the kind of business that they were looking to shut down. You know, we weren't bankers. We weren't a bank. We had tons of enthusiasm. Let me tell you, when they announced this license, we had plans for incubation at the center. So that was going to be a workspace there for companies that were literally spanning the whole globe. We had people in Asia and in Europe and South America writing to us, please let us come, you know, incubate this project in the Bitcoin Center. You know, as we saw, we had all this press of CNN and all, I don't know, all the media. We had tons of media. We were in the New York Times and more, and all these people would see it. And we had a list that was just very, very deep, including some companies that that company or kind of the offspring of companies that are relatively large in the space today. One of the first mining consumer mining companies, one of the first ATM companies, an exchange that exists today, very large. The founders were initially, we were working with them initially. But when the day that bit license came, the interest dried up overnight. I mean, within days, everybody was like, well, I don't think I want to go to New York anymore. And you know, what could I say? I couldn't sell them. I'm like, you're probably right. What do you want to go to New York for? So the regulator really nipped it in the bud. I'll tell you, if that's what they were going for, it was very effective because all of the energy of people that were coming to coalesce in New York, they didn't come. I mean, they didn't come. And now there's some bit licenses issued. I think there's maybe 15 or 20 issued now. But as you might remember, for the first 4 years or 5 years, they issued two in 5 years, two in 4 years. And Ben Losky, the guy who was the head of the department who issued this bit license, a week before or after, like within a week of it being issued, he went and opened a consulting firm so that, you know, And I don't want to name names because, you know, it's probably the smart thing to do. But there's some firms that hired him and they got it in 2 weeks. And there's other firms like Bitstamp who waited 5 years. And there's other firms like Bittrex who were in the process for years and then ended up getting rejected publicly, like with the most unprofessional. Anyway.
And they drive away all the mind power.
And they were seeking to come, you know, from all over the world, and the regulator drove it away. You know, people have to understand about the Department of Financial Services, it only existed since like 1 or 2 years, like 2012. It was only around for about 2 years. Bielowski was the first ever chairman. I mean, it was complete ego self-promotion on his part, and I guess a favor to the banks, because, you know, what was always said then and what is said now is about how the banks and the existing legacy system was so slow. And maybe it's true, because now, only now, which is, I guess we're over 6 years after all this happened, only now are we seeing backed or the first real like bank-backed exchange, which is from ICE. No, I know ICE isn't a bank, but basically of a legacy financial type exchange that's making waves in New York. It's only happening now.
But everything is getting more and more regulated. I mean, I think you know it best, huh?
Well, the public businesses are getting more and more regulated. But as you get more people that understand Bitcoin, you also have tons. I don't know much about them, you know. I keep a clean nose, but I think you also have a lot more like peer-to-peer and anonymous activities going on, and software being made. I don't mean like dark market activities. I mean like software that's being made that's censorship resistant or decentralized as well.
So you stopped at the Bitcoin Center in New York, and then
I went to Dubai and was looked kind of how the Bitcoin economy was shaping up in Dubai, and I helped organize a Bitcoin conference in December of 2013 in Dubai. Also, in the meantime, I had ridden my bike across Canada, actually, in like July or August. We rode the bike for about 3 months across Canada. And much of U.S.
With
and,
which bike?
Like a bicycle.
Yeah. But road cycling? Or
it was like kind of made for touring. Yeah. But I mean, it wasn't the... Man, yeah. It cost me... that's like $1 million bicycle right now at this point. I don't even... I mean, I sold it a long time ago. But
you bought it with Bitcoin?
I bought it. Well, all I had was Bitcoin. Yeah.
Oh, really?
I think I was like pretty much living on Bitcoin for quite a while. I also started a... the first ever... I think it was the first... like Bitcoin political organization. It was called Bitcoin Super PAC. I think it was around for some months, 6 months or so. But then the bank shut our account down and gave us a check, but it wasn't for much because we hadn't begun raising money. And I couldn't get a new bank account. So I spent literally about 2 or 3 weeks, like a full-time job, looking to get a bank account, and this was in Manhattan, there's a lot of banks, going to every single bank, and we couldn't get a bank account. So I was naive back then. I shouldn't have named it Bitcoin whatever, but Bitcoin Super PAC, but yeah. So then in December of 2013, that's when I started at Kraken. I started as account manager, and I think there was between like maybe 20 and 30 employees there. I think at the time, really, I was kind of focusing on obviously like VIP account management, but also outbound sales. And I think I was one of, if not the first, kind of salesman for any of the major exchanges, where that was like kind of my chief and sole duty.
What does that mean? I mean, what does a salesman for exchanges do?
Well, I would contact kind of similar organizations or profiles, or I had already been in the industry for some time, so I knew a lot of people, and I would contact them and say, "Why aren't you trading on Kraken? I work here now. Come trade on Kraken." because now I'm here and I help you out. And then I would see some of the more, at that time, you know, it was nothing compared to today, but some of the more professional or institutional market makers and traders, I would take a look at like kind of the profile, what type of, you know, who are these people that are trading? He's tiny back then compared to today, and just try to figure out who, based on who was trading today, well, who might be trading tomorrow, and with some success, with pretty good success.
As I said at the beginning, there are several ways to store your Bitcoin securely. But in a way, you always have to trust the manufacturer, of course. That is why I love to know who are the people behind these products, what makes them tick, what are their values and goals, can I trust them? That's one of the reasons why I do these interviews, for me and for you. So if you are one of the people who thinks of investing in Bitcoin long term and in the most easy way and who prefers not to use a hardware wallet, then the Card Wallet is for you. You'll get one Bitcoin address, you can send Bitcoin to it, and all you have to do is to store it in a safe place. That's it. The manufacturers are the Austrian State Printing House, which is also responsible for the Austrian passports, and Coinfinity, Austria's first Bitcoin broker. Order your Card Wallet now at cardwallet.com/Anita and get 20% off the price. And today, what's your position or area of responsibility today?
Well, you know.
You don't have a job title.
Yeah, a few things. But mostly what I've been working on is a few smaller markets and trying to launch like subsidiary exchanges in smaller markets. So I can't speak too much about it, but hopefully we'll make a big public, you know, push on it very soon. But
okay,
you're gonna see new. You're gonna see exchanges everywhere for every marketplace, I hope, because eventually in areas today that either don't have the local demand or they're driven by OTC or whatever, everywhere, I think sub-Saharan Africa, you've seen Binance launched Binance Uganda. In 10 years, that's going to be the largest financial firm in Uganda. The same, I was just speaking to somebody who's launching in Guatemala, like a Guatemalan, I forget what the name of the currency is. It's a funny one, but a Guatemalan Bitcoin exchange, that'll probably be the biggest, you know, bank in the country in 10 or 15 years.
I heard you speaking in another podcast interview or video about Zimbabwe. You have to been to Zimbabwe this year?
Yeah, I went to Zimbabwe this year. I've been to Zimbabwe and South Africa just in the last couple of months. It's kind of incredible in Zimbabwe how much of... there's so many industrious people. It's a crazy. There's production of like incredible products. Literally the best butter I've ever tasted in my life, and I'm a big butter enthusiast. I bought at a market in Harare. I mean, literally the incredible stuff. Tons of productive capacity there, potential, and to see how much mental energy the most motivated and brightest and ambitious people in that country put to dealing with the government money, to figuring out how to get out of it, how to trade without it or around it, or to hold it for the shortest time possible, and try to read the tea leaves and forecast what's happening tomorrow. It must be half of all the productive potential is wasted on thinking about these things.
Yeah, I think it's even more. I have a friend there, and she tells me that most of the time she's just checking, like, if the power outtakes are ending again, or if they get gas, or if they can buy something to eat, or yeah, if they can use their cards or not. So, and I think in the last months they also banned the U.S. dollar.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the enforcement's like, but they did ban the U.S. dollar, and they have these RTGS, forget the acronym, but the new money, the new Zimbabwe dollar, yeah. It's called RTGS, and they've mandated that all payments must be made in RTGS, and I believe we're back on track for, you know, 100% inflation per month or something like that. It's only been a month or so since I've been there, but the last I heard... The exchange rate has gone, has more than doubled since then, it's very destructive.
And did you look around? I mean, do people use Bitcoin there, or do they want to have it?
Well, there's the main problem there is with supply. So there's actually a very long-standing Bitcoin exchange there called Golix. It's been around since 2013. The founders there are very, very bright and definitely had a lot of foresight. But the problem with the markets there, with the open order book markets, is that there's very little supply, which is the problem in all kind of capital-controlled countries, because why would you want to send the greatest money that's ever been existed in and buy the worst money that's ever existed? So naturally, there's a massive premium. There's been a premium for years and years and years. What I've heard, though, is that there is a marketplace, but that it's mostly over-the-counter and peer-to-peer, which is, you know, probably that's partly just the nature of the distrust in the banking system, because nobody wants to, if you can avoid it, nobody wants to utilize the banking system even to fund an exchange account or any of the rest. And I think the banks are somewhat hostile to the idea of Bitcoin. And it's also a great way to kind of learn, right? Some of the most kind of some of the best learning experiences I had early on were just meeting with people to do small trades in a coffee shop or something, and then sitting down for hours and, you know, just meeting somebody super excited to tell you about the blockchain or some aspect they had thought about it. I remember that's the first I ever heard of the blockchain. I was sitting in a cafe on 14th Street in New York. The guy, we were doing a very small trade. And he was saying about how he thought that mining was going to change and become, which is borne out. I remember he was saying, "Oh, it's going to be very industrial. You're going to have the biggest energy companies in the world, and they're going to be mining on the blockchain and all this." And he taught me a bunch. So sorry to rant.
Which might be true, huh?
But Bitcoin's an energy unit. Yeah. Bitcoin is a battery. So as we progress, all energy interests are going to look very heavily in Bitcoin, very heavily. All the major oil-producing nations, Bitcoin at its core is a battery. So it really is going to change everything when it comes to energy production. And the thing, as I understand about generation, and when you're building out capacity, is that you have to basically plan years ahead of time. So you have to kind of aim where you think the demand is going to be. And one of the reasons why a lot of the mining the last few years has been in China and more remote areas of China is because they've centrally planned all this capacity that no one ever came. No one ever came to generate the capacity. So you have to do something with it. You have to you know, shut the turbines down, or you have to pump it into the ground. But mining equipment literally goes inside the dam, and then they take the energy and they beam it into space, and then they make money out of it, and they store it as a battery, and then you can go somewhere else and use the money to buy energy.
Yeah, you store the energy in the Bitcoin.
Yeah, the Bitcoin value, is a battery.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also a very interesting fact in Bitcoin, yeah. That it will also change the way we, hopefully change the way how we produce energy or electricity.
Well, and how we consume.
Yeah, I hope
consume
so.
Consume
yeah.
Everything, I think. And this is something because I think I was, well, anyway, very happy that a lot of people in this past year, a couple years, are discussing time preference and fiat and Bitcoin, because this is something I've always wondered why, or I've always thought that since even before I got into Bitcoin, I was always wondering why kind of environmental groups and other sort of like kind of left-wing populist type interest groups didn't focus on central banking more, because central banking is absolutely disastrous for the environment. It puts like basically a flame on your back to consume now, no matter what. And as far as income inequality and the ability of even very intelligent, industrious people born into lower classes to rise, it's a disaster for that too.
Yeah. You were talking about legal texts before, how they are written. I think you have a lot to do with regulators and lawmakers, huh?
I keep an eye on it, but I've had so over the years I've had a lot of interactions and experience and direct interactions with regulators and with Kraken and prior. So kind of I was a you know, how do they call this birth by fire or something? Is that a phrase you've ever heard? But in New York, you know, it was kind of thrust upon me to try to do my best to understand how we could possibly continue our business and launch our business. And I've had some experience with regulators at Kraken.
Because I guess in every country where Kraken sets up a subsidiary, it has to know about the legal stuff, you know?
Yeah, and it's very tough because a lot of it is just doesn't exist. A lot of the legal structure about for our activities doesn't exist. So, but one thing about Kraken that has paid off massive dividends has been, since day one, the founders of Kraken wanted to kind of have a professional exchange, and they preempted kind of a lot of the regulations that are coming now. So if you regulators can kind of look back years and years and years and see that we've been following their prescription since far before they had ever heard of it or mentioned Bitcoin. So I think that gives Kraken a lot of legitimacy in the eyes of regulators. And you know, just we've been around since 2011 and never had any kind of major security incident. And
But you also have to store the users' KYC and AML papers, do you?
Yeah, exactly. And Kraken's never had any anonymous trading on its platform since day one. So that's a huge differentiator than a lot of the exchanges today that are trying to become compliant but weren't in the past. And it's caused a lot of headaches for them.
And what's your opinion on Facebook's Libra?
Well, I understand people who say that it'll generate a lot of interest and attention, but I'm definitely not a fan, and I think it's an attack on Bitcoin. I don't think it helps Bitcoin in the long run at all. You know, I'm not. I do understand where people are coming from when they say that it is going to give attention, but if we look at what's happened so far, the only attention is from the wrong people. The potential user base, Bitcoin's potential user base, they haven't cared at all about Libra. All the all these people living in all these despotic countries that are in every country that has a horrendous monetary policy, they haven't even noticed. You know, the mainstream hasn't noticed at all. It's all just basically the regulators who have taken notice of it, and it's probably not good.
I mean, privacy-wise, it can't be good, in my opinion.
No. I've deleted my Facebook account, and the reason is because I was too naive when I had created it to understand the implications of volunteering this massive amount of data to. So that they can understand me more than I understand myself, possibly, right? And to add financial data to that, it is so powerful. It is the next big thing, I guess. I mean, it will all the issues that people have with Facebook, it'll double the ability for Facebook to control. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, they can even control smaller countries who have like a smaller GDP than Facebook has in its specs.
Well, you can imagine if Facebook has the Libra, what would you call this? The portfolio or the basket. So Libra is going to be backed by a basket of assets, liquid assets. But you can imagine someday where, Libra really does become the de facto payment tool for billions of people, and then the Swiss government wants to protect privacy rights for its citizens, and Libra says, "Oh well, if you do that, we're dropping you out of the basket, and you're going to be devalued overnight to the tune of 20%." And they say, "Oh shit!"
Yeah, and they can do what they want, basically.
Yeah, well, especially after this. After Libra becomes an asset to that, that's utilized to that degree, then they can really do what they want. And I've just had the feeling since day one that it's bad for Bitcoin. It's an attack on Bitcoin. But I don't think it's a weak attack on Bitcoin. I think because it doesn't it's just more of the same but worse. And in complete contrast to Bitcoin, which is none of the same, better than none of the same and better.
What do you think? In which countries is Bitcoin understood the most and the fastest?
It's probably hard to say, because one thing that we've been talking about a lot lately is kind of how. I'm in a bubble, I'm in a bubble that's very Anglo-centric, English speakers who are of relatively high income, relatively well educated, relatively young. And there was a wonderful presentation from the CEO of Bitrefill, where he basically drew the distinction that we may be members of the Bitcoin community here, but most people using Bitcoin, they're not members of the community. Just like most people using BitTorrent, they have no idea like the political conversations at the BitTorrent Foundation over what protocol change is going to occur, and they have no idea what the best torrent tracker or what the best torrent client is. They just say, "Oh well, my brother introduced me to Pirate Bay and downloaded Azura or whatever on my computer, so that's the one I use." And that's the vast majority of Bitcoin users. That's exactly the same thing. They don't even know that these other softwares exist. They have no idea what the arguments are, the protocol arguments, or they just use Bitcoin because they need to use Bitcoin. And that's going to be more and more and more so the case. But I'm getting the feeling that there's some evidence to show that kind of I think we could be much closer than people think to kind of a critical mass of understanding in places like Argentina and Turkey and places that have currencies that are disastrous. Capital controls are getting stronger all the time. I get the feeling that in Iran, Bitcoin understanding is very far along, and I think we're going to continue that trek. But one thing that would probably help that along is more documentation in languages other than like English and Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's important too, because most of the literature and talks are in English.
All of the ones I've read.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sure there's a massive Chinese language user base, so I'm sure there's a lot of documentation there. But it's really interesting, especially through all of the contentiousness surrounding fork and protocol changes, how wide the gap is between kind of the Chinese community and the Western community. And there's not too many intermediaries or translators for that. So it's probably also the case the world over. We spoke about Zimbabwe. I imagine if you were to take the sum total of like kind of sub-Saharan Bitcoin users, very, very, very few of them have any idea about the discussions about block size and node management and things like that. Very few. But we should make efforts to change that, because you don't need the entire user base to understand, but you do need some of the user base to understand, to maintain the censorship resistance to of Bitcoin.
Does Bitcoin or the things around Bitcoin still surprise you in a way?
Well, I'm learning all the time, every day, constantly. Here at the Baltic Honey Badger, it's, you know, there's a lot of subpar, I think, conferences. This is not one of them. I think every single presentation that was made here, I would learn something from. As far as surprising me, I think it just the speed at which Bitcoin's grown is the. If I were to look back years ago, as like kind of, you know, getting me nostalgic for a bygone era here with this discussion. If I were to look back at what I would have thought in the Bitcoin Center era, I would have never imagined that it would be this big this quickly. It's big. I think it's big, and I think it happened very quickly. And I think the growth is going to be when you chunk out, when you zoom out, in the future, we're going to see that the growth was exponential. I mean, we're in a 2-year period here that is, you know, relatively sideways, but you know, that's the pattern that we've seen, and it kind of matches the pattern of the issuance as well. So we're sideways in terms of the price. That's what I mean to say. I don't mean to say that we're sideways in terms of understanding or adoption, because one amazing thing that came a fruit that was born from the 2017 rally was all of these people who kind of just got into it to so that they could you know, make 5x in 2 days off of some shitcoin. Many of those people probably just, you know, lost all their money and never thought about it since. But a very important minority of them just kept digging, got very excited. Now they understand. Now some of them are understanding the protocol. They're understanding the social implications, the political implications, and they're spreading that word farther. But price really is a driver, so...
Yeah, so now Jimmy Song is singing a song for us. So let's close it. Do you have any recommendations for our listeners about literature or videos about Bitcoin for newbies?
Yeah, there's a lot of great ones. I'm not going to remember the URLs exactly, but definitely lop.net, where Jameson Lop has a resource page, is amazing. Bitcoin only. There's a site that's growing quickly. Bitcoin only, a very good one. If you want to dive deeper and you haven't, for those that are interested in kind of the potential political ramifications of Bitcoin, the Bitcoin Standard is a very interesting take.
And where can people find you and follow your work? Don't you want that?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Follow my work. I haven't written much publicly or anything. I go on Twitter by once a week. So otherwise, you know, it eats your whole life away. But you can follow me on Twitter at BTCIsMoney. One word, BTCIsMoney.
Which says everything, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe when I retire from Kraken, I'll start writing more on there or something. I don't know.
Great. Thank you for being my guest. It was a great interview, and I really like to talk with you each time we meet.
Oh, I guarantee the pleasure is all mine. Guaranteed, for sure.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Thanks to my sponsors at Shift Crypto Security and their Bitbox O2. You can get free shipping now with code ANITA. And thanks to Coinfinity and the Card Wallet, you can get 20% off at cardwallet.com/Anita. And as always, this is a podcast, not financial advice. Please do your own research. If you like my show, please subscribe to it in your podcast player and share the episode on social media. You can find all links that were mentioned in the show notes on the website or in your podcast player. If you are in the mood for a donation, feel free to tip me at tippinme@AnitaPosh. You can contact me also on Twitter, LinkedIn, or YouTube.
Goodbye from Vienna. Auf Wiederhören. Music, Start with Yes, Delicate Beats. Idea, Content and Production, yours truly, Anita Posch.